Hello and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land to mouth food, farm, and garden radio show that comes your way every week live at 1 o'clock. We usually go till about 2 this week in the garden. Pat joining us later in the hour every week. Coming up tonight, we're going to be out at the farm doing a workshop on season extension. And that's an exciting thing. We just had our first frost just a couple of days ago. So 2 days ago now, we've had a couple of frosts overnight. So what did we do? We averaged 9 days earlier than they thought. We were just talking last week about the first average frost date being predicted to be on October the 25th. Well, we ended up with it around the 17th with this cold blast of air that came in. And boy, did it show in the garden compared to covering something or not covering something. Well, if it wasn't covered and it wasn't really hardy, it is hammered at this point. And we've got many great tips and techniques for you to be able to extend this season, keep things producing. Different things, of course, have different abilities to withstand the cold. Many things just aren't going to go that long in the cold, but you can extend it a bit. Other things like the brassicas will just keep going along, chugging along pretty steadily, and we'll learn more about that tonight at Living Web Farms. If you can get registered, go on over to livingwebfarms.org and get your registration in. We look forward to seeing you this evening and Pat teaching us all about those fantastic season extension techniques, which make us able to grow more fresh food really pretty much year-round. You can do it with certain things. And then, of course, we look forward to getting back out into the regular temperatures come springtime again. But to be able to winter garden is a wonderful thing, and it keeps us much healthier because we have those fresh greens even in those cold temperatures. Well, it's been a beautiful fall week, just in full glory, sun out, clear skies, leaves changing and falling, and it's definitely the turning of the season, getting into those chillier times and moving into completing our harvest, cleaning up the garden, looking at where we've come this year and where we want to go as we get ready for the holiday time and winter time. Certainly lots of great news and information to share. More and more going on around the world, people waking up to just how important eating healthy is, healthy food, organic food. As I mentioned last week, over 700 McDonald's stores are now closed. Yes, they are closing, not really serving up good, pure food. Why be in business anyway, right? Well, people are saying no to McDonald's food more and more often, making those correlations to what they're eating and their health, and they're having to scale back. Same thing with Monsanto. So many countries are saying, no, thank you. We don't want that poison stuff. No, thank you. They have dropped their share price. They've dropped their amount of employees. They've dropped in value, and even their credit rating has dropped. So good news on the front of more organic demand out there in the market for food. We are driving that demand through our choices every single day. More schools getting organic food served up in those cafeterias, more school gardens growing, even more colleges now majoring in food type related careers. Universities and colleges are realizing, hey, people want to learn this stuff. This is popular. Yes, of course, you know, learning how to eat well is an important topic. The fact that we have shoved it over and just been eating food-like products for a lot of our consumption of what is supposed to be nourishing, whole food. No, we've been eating these packaged food products with fancy commercials and empty nutritional profiles. And now colleges are starting to realize, hey, people are interested in this. This is important. This is a hot topic. More culinary and education classes on the horizon, opportunities to major in food. Yes, colleges are getting hip with this, getting more young people in those kitchens. And we're talking about students jumping in there, filling up waiting lists, getting involved in the undergraduate courses, in the degree programs. In Washington, they have doubled in their academics of people coming for culinary. It's really exciting. We are talking about food studies, harvest to health. This is the sort of programs that are being developed. U.S. food and nutrition policy. Things that were very small niche markets before are now growing in population, in demand. People with a surging interest in food as an academic subject extends beyond the classroom and really reaches into our everyday life. And it really is the foundation for our health, our ability to make those healthier choices every time we're going to eat something. places where students are volunteering with food justice groups or getting more involved in community activities regarding food. It's very exciting. Young people doing this and more young farmers, the seeds of farming growing in more hearts around the world and people getting together in teams, working on gardens together. And that's what makes our community strong. And you know what? Living Web Farms videos help empower those teams. Because when you have a team and maybe you don't all live in the same house or in the same neighborhood or even in the same town, hey, let's all watch this series. And next thing you know, when you get back together to work on that community garden, maybe you've got those skills getting in order because you were able to watch that workshop online from the comfort of your own home or desk or office. And we've got to be able to get that information out there, share it with more people, and then take action on more garden teams and in our own gardens, right? So very exciting, everywhere from Stanford University to Berkeley to places here in Western North Carolina, University of Vermont, University of Michigan, places all over are getting involved in this. And then over in Indiana, they developed the first PhD there at the university in the anthropology of food. That was back in 2007. Indiana University reports an upswing in the addition of an interest in food-related courses, and food was even a university-wide focus for the spring semester. We've got the Food Better Challenge. Deans at Harvard College last fall put out a call to all students to come up with ideas for improving the health, social, and environmental outcomes of the food system worldwide. This resulted in a year-long focus on food issues throughout the Ivy League institution. Tufts University has added an online certificate program in sustainable agriculture and food systems. This is catering to a crush of interest from professionals working in the food system, and the demand is increasing across the board. New York University has seen applications for enrollment in its Master of Arts in Food Studies increase from 80 in 2005 to around 170 today. And the university has increased its food and nutrition offerings from 30 classes a decade ago to 60 today. All in all, more than 70 community colleges, four-year colleges, and universities now have specific degree programs for sustainable agriculture food systems. This growth in interest on college campuses nationwide comes at a time when interest in food and specifically local sustainable food is fomenting in popular culture at large, says Pioneer Food Systems educator Dr. Molly Anderson of Middlebury College in Vermont. This is trickling down and just pervading our entire communities, people really waking up to diet, health, that land-to-mouth food, farm, and garden connection is so powerful and so great to see young people celebrating that and making the connection. More edible schoolyards happening, more community gardens. It's great to see. Most young people have been very cut off from wholesome food in general, en masse, and now it's time to turn that around. Thank you to KQED.org in the Bay Area for Bay Area Bites, giving us this great story about the growth of interest in dealing with food, creating food in your own home and in your own community, and growing it sustainably so that it's healthy and great for us. I mentioned the Food Justice from Seed to Market online event. This is an Omega Center for Sustainable Living online event with Dr. Vandana Shiva, as well as Ken Green, Jalal Sabour, Natasha Bowens, and more. Wanted to let you know the registration for that event is closed, but we have an opportunity to still see that live online through November 11th. So it's available until November 11th, and you can check that out and find out more information on this fantastic workshop that's going on. Dr. Vandana Shiva is a world-renowned environmental leader, ecofeminist author and thinker, director of the Research Foundation on Science, Technology, and Ecology. She's a leader on the International Forum on Globalization, along with Ralph Nader and Jeremy Rifkin. She's a recipient of many awards, and you can check her out at navdanya.org. She is a fantastic teacher, great to learn from, and extremely passionate. Also joining her will be Ken Green, Jalal Sabour, Natasha Bowens, and Will Allen. Yes, Will Allen, the super community garden jumpstarter, farmer, founder, and CEO of Growing Power, Inc. He'll be in part of this workshop there. He's recognized as a preeminent practitioner of urban agriculture in our country and throughout the world. Check him out at growingpower.org. Wonderful information there. I look forward to trying to check that out in the next month. That is available at eomega.org, online learning from Food Justice from Seed to Market. Great event, watchable until November 11th. So check that out. It's always good to have great information on super educational opportunities with the world's leaders in this movement. And you know, nature is resilient. We've got to hang in there sometimes. Sometimes we've got to hang in there long after we thought we couldn't. Maybe we've gone through something we didn't even know we could withstand. We didn't even know if we could hang on that long until things turned around. But you know what? Tenacity, perseverance, fortitude counts. It's very important. Nature's got it. We learn it from nature, and we can do it too. We can hang in there even when the odds seem impossible. We can do it. And we've done it many times in the past. I have a recent personal experience that I very much relate to regarding that. And in Winnipeg, they had an example of nature doing it in a very powerful way recently. A Winnipeg student grew a rare squash seed from seeds that were 800 years old. Yes, students in Winnipeg were given a rather unique opportunity to revive a vegetable that was thought to be extinct. Sometimes we think relationships are extinct. Oh, I don't even know if I have that connection anymore. Sometimes we doubt our connections. We doubt our ability to revivify, to come back to life in our true nature. Well, they grew. This particular squash that they were introduced to was thought to be extinct, and they grew it from seeds approximately 800 years old, and then are now reviving this vegetable. And we are able to do that in our lives. We rekindle our passion, our purpose, and we come together with those we love and share our passion and purpose with in community, in our homes and everywhere, and we can have great, strong, wonderful, healthy connections. So fantastic to see. Can you imagine the miracle growing an 800-year-old seed? I mean, every once in a while you have a few-year-old seed that won't germinate. So thankfully it was put in some kind of condition that allowed that seed to just hang in there for 800 years. Quite amazing to think of the world that was in existence the last time that squash was cultivated. But there they are, eating it up in Winnipeg for the first time in 800 years. So thanks to the National News of APTN there for that great story. Fantastic to hear. And sometimes we've got to really stand up for what nature is showing us, for what nature's providing. We don't need to keep genetically engineering things to actually contaminate nature. We are finding out more and more that the genetically engineered organisms are contaminatory. They will actually displace and contaminate other organic species. They are filled with different types of characteristics that are unleashed when we start tampering with that genetic code that we have no idea what we're doing. And people are out there taking a stand. We heard from Dr. Richard McDonald, the award-winning entomologist who taught the farmscaping workshop there at Living Web Farms a few years ago. What an astute gentleman. And he was telling us just how important it is not to be planting these genetically engineered loblolly pine trees. But they're out there, they're being planted, and people are definitely opposing it. Lots of folks realize what a danger it is. And there on globaljusticeecology.org, we get a recent story here from Ann Peterman, Executive Director for Global Justice Ecology. She's also the project and coordinator for International Campaign to Stop the Genetically Engineered Trees. They were down there in South Carolina, yes, not very far from where we are here in Western North Carolina. They were protesting the planting of genetically engineered trees from the ArborGen company. They are campaigning for ecology and global justice and working on stopping these genetically engineered trees that are a menace. They're a potential threat to the ecology there. And yes, they were arrested while trying to raise awareness about ArborGen's plans to create genetically engineered loblolly pine trees without giving the public any information about them. You know, whatever happened to public disclosure in America? You know, we had the recent Trans-Pacific Partnership full text. Somebody leaked it, and that's how we find out? Because somebody had to let out a secret about what's going to control 40% of the global economy? Certainly there should be some public dialogue on these matters, not just corporate backwater deals that are going to continue to have escalating hidden costs because there are many ecocidal industries trying to cash in on what's left of nature. And what we've got to do is take positive, powerful, peaceful action. And they are looking to have some public discourse on this. We don't have awareness about these plans, about these trees. We just have them being shoved through, being passed, being planted in places that will contaminate other healthy organic crops. And meanwhile, around the world, GMOs are being rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected across Europe, across Russia, Latvia, Croatia, you know, France, Scotland, Ireland, all over the world. We have many, many countries saying no, including Guatemala, many, many, many places. And there's some, there's been some real hell to pay in some cases. There's heavy duty lawsuits going on. There's people that have been, you know, in danger because of this. It's heavy duty stuff, but we've got to be protecting our sanctity of life here and our ability to have our strong thousands of year old heirloom species, things that will withstand the climate change and the adaptation of things that's going on. We've got this combination, right, of the climate adapting, and then we also have geoengineering happening, and all of these effects. When we're learning sustainable agricultural models, will provide a solid cornerstone, a stable, steady foundation. And so moving toward these sustainable methods and moving away from these scientifically blind, in many cases just outright false results that are really endangering us, these diabolical genetically engineered organisms are out there really causing health problems, really causing massive allergy problems in people, organ failure, tumors, you name it. But we don't hear about it. Here in America, we don't hear about it as often. In other countries, they're aware of it and they're banning it. But in Ridgeville, South Carolina, ArborGen's unassuming greenhouses sitting all over there just a little ways down the road from here, the company is secretly developing and testing loblolly pine trees that have been genetically engineered with fundamental changes to the tree's wood. Now, we heard about this from Dr. Richard McDonald, as I said, and he talks about it, and I encourage you to check out the Dr. McBug video, Farmscaping, there on livingwebfarms.org. He was very aware of this a while ago because he's very up on these topics. These genetically engineered pine trees are being developed with no opportunity at all for the public to learn when or where ArborGen plans to sell them or plant them. The public is also being given absolutely zero information on the risks of these trees. Now, Dr. McDonald does talk about it a little bit in our video, but you don't hear public disclosure on this. But yet we would be exposed to these things. So definitely unethical practices going on there at ArborGen. These risks are potentially extremely serious. Pine trees are well known for heavy pollination. And this is what Dr. McDonald was talking about, was the pollination contamination factor here. Things are traveling on wind. These things are not staying in a greenhouse or in a field. They are moving. The air masses are migratory. They're swapping air with all kinds of other crops. This is the danger, one of the biggest inherent dangers in this. What will be the impact on people's health from inhaling genetically engineered pollen, especially people already suffering from pollen allergies? And those are pollen allergies that they're reacting to things that nature created, never mind something where you've tripped a few switches and activated thousands of variants in the genetic potentiation factor of what may come. So extreme genetic roulette going on. How far will the pollen spread? Well, it contaminates other pines. It can travel along animals, on wind, with insects that are pollinating. It can kill insects, potentially. We've got woodpeckers, songbirds, deer, turkey, all the wildlife potentially being affected by this extreme pollen, you know, factor of genetically engineered pollen, where we don't even know what the effects are. There's no public discourse. There's no real studies. There's certainly no long-term studies of this sort of genetic roulette going on, but it's certainly endangering things right away. Even now, even the tests they've got there right now, those pollens are getting out and affecting things. The key questions are not being answered. ArborGen is barreling ahead with plans for their genetically engineered loblolly pines with no concern to the damage they are causing or may cause, only to the money that they could make. And when we're so blind and all we can think of is how high the pile of money goes, well, it can kind of fall over with hidden costs and cost everyone way too much. And these ecocidal business models are not sustainable. So therefore, they're not good business models. If you can't stay in business to make a profit, then you're not in a good business model. You have to refine that. And temporary profit for long-term devastation of our environment and our own health is certainly not a trade worth making. The public has the right to know. ArborGen's wall of secrets must come down. We need to take some action on exposing these secret plans where genetically engineered crops are being exposed to other healthier crops and contaminating them. Other countries are smartening up. They're banning this stuff. We need to do it right now. And I encourage you to take action at globaljusticeecology.org. Fantastic information there. And they are working very, very diligently to ban these genetically engineered trees. And they need our help. And that's the one thing I always encourage you, is to take action on things you care about, because that will uplift your spirit just enough to get you to that next moment where you can make another small difference, and peacefully, powerfully, positively, every day, every step in the right direction counts. So if this calls out to you, please let your voice be heard. GlobalJusticeEcology.org. And thank you to those folks for taking such diligent action on such an important issue. One of those little sleeper issues, you know, that's secretly planting this stuff, secretly infiltrating our air with it, secretly getting it out there. Well, I'm here to tell you, it's not a secret. So let's help bring the awareness up on this issue and plant more native plant species. The more native plant species that we do put in the ground and cultivate, the more diverse native insects we get. And as Pat always reminds us, the more diversity we have in our local insects that are native, the more we have the built-in controls, because the insects keep each other in balance. All of life in the great living web works together in a symbiotic relationship of harmony and health and balance. And so when we see that parasitized hornworm, as I did so many years ago, I didn't know what it was, and I thought, oh, that poor little worm, you know, is getting invaded by something. Well, then I find out, oh, that's the hornworm that destroys the tomatoes. That's the parasitizing wasp who will give birth to a bunch of little babies by laying the eggs on that little parasitized hornworm. And now there'll be a bunch more beneficial insects next year to keep those hornworms in check. So working with nature, increasing insect diversity, keeping nature alive in all of its forms is our ultimate balanced way to control invasions of various pests, right? As long as we keep the predator-prey balance going, nature will keep an amazing sense of equilibrium happening, and we learn from it and we keep supporting it. And next thing you know, we've got healthier organic soil and food and more native species. The native plants in a garden will increase the native insect population. So research your zone, find out what your most rare native plants are that need to be restored. Make a little native plant garden, perhaps, as a farmscaping addition to your garden. Add little clumps of native farmscaping around your property. And even if you don't have a vegetable garden, just get those native plants out there in little, sort of the guilds of plants that can work together just to support your native insect population. That is what is going to support the pollinators and all of the balance that we need to be seeking. So fantastic news to really see, actually. Science Daily reported recently that insect diversity decreases in gardens with non-native plants. Non-native plants reduce the diversity of insect populations in gardens, even where the non-native plants are closely related to the native plants. This is new research. The goal of this was to understand how the composition of plants that homeowners and people plant in their yards affects the herbivore communities. More non-native plants means less insect diversity. So, you know, I plant a lot of things I just love, and I want to get into more native plant gardens, because that's what's going to make more native insects in more diverse, complex populations appear. And they do. They just appear. It's like, oh my goodness, look at this insect I've never seen before. So if you didn't have something you had planted, and all of a sudden you plant it, and next thing you know, you've got a whole new population of a certain kind of insect family that is there to provide even more balance in your garden. So it's wonderful to see that, and I just want to encourage you to keep those native plants going. Maybe get some perennials in the ground here in the fall so they can be coming back by springtime, so that in the spring we're able to feed our early pollinators and the bees and the things that first come out after that long winter needing food. So see if you can get some perennial, beautiful native plants in the ground this fall and help give those biodiverse insect populations a jump start for springtime. Well, you know, we think about food and we think about organic food and health, and I'm so glad so many more people are becoming aware of it. But then there's the vast amount of population out there who's like, oh, I just can't afford that organic food. or, oh, it's just cheaper. Well, don't you think it's an interesting coincidence that the quote-unquote affordable food is subsidized by chemical companies? Of course, you know, okay, let's make it quote-unquote affordable to poison ourselves. That's not affordable. That costs your health. There's just about nothing more valuable than having your wealth of health from eating natural organic food. And sometimes in the process of making that choice, we forget about the hidden cost that eating toxic food is having on our body, on our awareness, on our organs, on our ability to function. And when you really think about it, like I say most of the time here, there is not a magic door. There's no little magic doorway where the food gets sprayed with poison and then turned into a food product and then now becomes not poison. There is no magic doorway like that. It's still toxic. People that eat pesticide-laden food can test their blood and their urine and show percents of all of these extremely toxic pesticides. Now, can you imagine how much the farm workers are testing for? Even if those poor little farm workers are out there, and I'm not saying they're poor little farm workers, but to me, anyone who's getting inundated with poisons is pitiful. It's a pitiful way to live, right? The farm workers, which probably they aren't, quote unquote, affording organic food. Some of them probably have their own garden because they're wise enough to know that. But farm workers, even if they're eating all organic, are exposed to vast amounts of pesticides. And their health is failing because of it. There's vast amounts of kidney failure with glyphosate-related, liver problems, every kind of cancer you can almost think of. Tons of things going on. And thankfully, thank you, HuffingtonPost.com, for this report. We are finally getting some new federal rules, and I don't think it's gone far enough, but we've got some new federal rules to better protect farm workers from these harmful pesticides. We depend on farm workers every day, and they deserve fair, equitable working standards along with strong health and safety precautions. There's estimated 2 million U.S. farm workers, children, and others who work or live near farm fields, and finally, they will have a little more protection from the hazardous pesticides, and these changes are being unveiled here recently, according to the Agricultural Worker Protection Standard. We're going to see some changes there, reducing the risk of injury and illnesses from contact with pesticides on farms and in forests, nurseries, and greenhouses. Now, of course, my stance is we need to ban these extremely dangerous compounds. We've just found out that glyphosate is carcinogenic to humans after 40 years of Monsanto knowing it and it being hidden. This is absolute crime against people and against nature. We have been poisoning ourselves far too long. So I'm into banning GMOs and banning these extremely dangerous compounds that we are just finding out the tip of the iceberg, how extremely dangerous they are. But these farm workers are out there extremely exposed. So EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy is talking about helping to get more equitable working standards with stronger health and safety precautions. Now, really, we need to go further, as I mentioned, but these changes have been badly needed for a population that is largely low income and made up of minorities. It's been a long time coming, and they're finally getting some help for these migrant workers. They have tasks that are done by hand on pesticide-treated crops, and of course, our skin is not a, it's not a barrier. It's a permeable, right? It's a permeable skin layer. We've got these chemicals able to go transdermal. They can go right through your skin. So for people to have to stand there and work touching all of these pesticide-treated crops all day, harvesting, thinning, pruning, they are mixing a lethal load of pesticides every day just by interacting with these crops in their body. United Farm Workers President Arturo Rodriguez said the changes were badly needed. It's been a long time coming. And in spite of the fact that they cover their face, cover this, cover that, it's poison. And it's really, I mean, I can't even imagine having to sit there and work in a thing like that. And then your children are born with all kinds of health problems and birth defects, and then you start getting sick and your whole life is just spiraling into disease states of toxicity. This is a travesty, right? Organic food should just be what we eat. We shouldn't have to make a choice between toxic food that's going to cause us all kinds of untold problems and organic food that's going to support life and love and happiness and functionality, right? U.S. scientists are studying how human health is affected by the use of herbicides, insecticides, and other farm chemicals in growing a variety of crops, and many of these effects have been hidden from us. There are things that have been known and hidden and ignored for decades. We've had consumer and environmental groups calling for greater controls on pesticide use for a very long time. And now, you know, we've got people really saying, hey, we've got to stop this. The EPA, United States Department of Agriculture, the National Institutes of Health, and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health have been overseeing an agricultural health study of nearly 90,000 people in Iowa and North Carolina, tracking the impact of factors including pesticide use. I would like to see that study. I wonder why we haven't seen it yet. But it's out there, over 90,000 people in Iowa and North Carolina. And of course, I'd like to see it especially because I live in North Carolina. And it'd be nice to know, again, why don't we have public disclosure? Where's our public disclosure on this? But thank you, HuffingtonPost.com, for that report. Digging deeper below what isn't even on the surface sometimes, bringing things to light, learning more. That's our job, right? We got to be informed. We need to be informed so that we can take good action out there. People are doing it. People are stepping up. People are helping the monarchs. Monarch Watch doing a fantastic job with their annual monarch butterfly tagging event just last month. They're trying to restore areas so that there's more habitat. They've had vast amounts of their habitat wiped out. Over 90% of the beautiful monarch butterflies that I love so much have been killed. These pesticides out there and threaten all of our pollinators, including bats, bees, various types of native bees, butterflies, moths, all of that is endangered by our irresponsible use of chemical pesticides. So we can do things differently, and so wonderful to see there on LJWorld.com, the Lawrence Journal World, a $527,154 grant for Monarch Watch to train tribes to restore butterfly habitats on their lands. Yes, indigenous people are going to be getting financial help here, over $500,000, to work with Monarch Watch to help restore their land and pollinator habitats. And you know what that means? That means these Indian tribes are going to have more stable insect populations that will allow them to grow their own food and to be more sustainable overall. Right now, Kansas University's Monarch Watch effort is getting more than $500,000 to enable a butterfly version of the old teach a man to fish proverb. Yes, it's happening. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation announced Monday that Monarch Watch would receive this more than $500,000 grant for its Building Tribal Capacity for Monarch Habitat Restoration project. Roughly half the money is coming from the Wildlife Foundation and half from matching funds, including, believe it or not, donations from Monsanto. Now, I wonder, because grants are very specific, are there stipulations? Are there stipulations on that money in that grant because it came from Monsanto? Are they going to limit their ability to reduce pesticide use? Are there stipulations? Are there strings attached on that money? I know there have been endowments at universities by Monsanto and Dow and these other chemical companies, and then they get in there and have a hand in writing the curriculum, promoting the idea of utilizing their toxic products. So I'm wondering if there's strings attached on this, but in fact, I'm still happy to see Monarch Watch getting this great big leap of support for the monarchs. In recent years, they've been largely focused on cultivating and distributing milkweed plants to help restore monarch butterfly habitats, and they're doing more and more of that. The Building Tribal Capacity Project will train 7 American Indian tribes, and I like to say Native American. It's not American Indian, right? We weren't in India when Columbus landed. It's Native American. But anyway, they are training 7 Native American tribes in eastern Oklahoma whose lands are beneath the Monarch Springs migration flight path. They're working on habitat restoration right along that migratory flight path. And there's a lot of training involved, kind of an A to Z in terms of taking new groups of people who are interested in restoring habitat through the whole process. Trainees will learn to plant donated milkweed plugs as well as collect, press, process, store, and propagate seeds of milkweed and native forbs or flowering plants, according to a project description from the Wildlife Foundation. So fantastic to see. Congratulations, Monarch Watch. Can't wait to also have all those young people and all of the native people there on those reservations learning how to steward the land and their pollinator habitats, learning how to live in harmony with those butterflies and helping to sustain them on their migratory route. They're going to establish seed production plots, create demonstration plots, develop conservation plans, including site selection, preparation, and long-term maintenance. Monarch Watch has interest from even more tribes, but more money will be needed to broaden the project beyond the seven that have signed up so far. They're very interested in maintaining the cultural contact with the landscape and the landscape as it used to be and as it can be again. So that land to mouth food, farm, and garden connection with habitat and with biodiversity is such a powerful connection. And you know, humans are healthier when they make it. When we get back out there in nature and we walk in the forest and we plant the seeds in the fields and we gather the harvest and we share it with each other, we're healthier. We're psychologically more sound. We're more balanced. It's more fun. That's how we become more emotionally stable, is by getting away from our desk sometimes, getting out there in nature, and celebrating our ability to be earth stewards and the wonderful job that we all have on that same team of stewarding the earth and the land. So fantastic to see. To help this rebound for the Monarchs. They've got a commitment to environmental sustainability there, and they're working on it. Lots of other recipients can be found listing this grant, but great to see money being put to a fantastic use and restoring some of the milkweed habitat out there. It has been cut down and replaced with GMO crops, with pesticide-laden crops. So these poor butterflies have been out there having to forage these crops that are killing them. And I'll say hi. Hello, you're on Earth Heart Network Radio.
Well, hello. How's the weather up there?
This is my mom, everyone, and we are here in Western North Carolina where fall is so beautiful. And it's even more beautiful because we have a new North Carolinian back home. That's right. Avery is home, and fall is beautiful. And we just had our first freeze the last two nights, so the garden isn't quite as perky. We've got some hammered plants out there, but the chilled freezing nights now in full fall mode. Well, this is my mom, everyone, and I just want to say to Rita, happy birthday. Happy birthday, Rita, because tomorrow's her birthday, and there's a special surprise box with some wonderful fall squash and onions and garlic and all kinds of stuff and a few other surprises that should be arriving just in time for your beautiful fall birthday tomorrow.
Okay, well, I'm going to let you go, and I thank you for those gifts because you know how I've been wanting them.
I know. She loves that farm food, and she's eating organic all the time. So big hug to you, Mom, and you should get that awesome package tomorrow.
Love you, Lisa.
Love you, too. Talk to you soon. Bye. She accidentally calls sometimes during my show, but I thought, you know, let's just say hi. Let's just say hi for a second and say hi to Mom because tomorrow's her birthday. And she's going to love it. She's going to love her little package. We got to get that thing in the mail yesterday, and there's some homemade gifts as well as some homegrown gifts. So a wonderful joy to be able to share that. But more monarchs, hopefully getting their habitat protected and getting them replacing some of this poison stuff, getting more of the milkweed out there. And remember, protect your woke milkweed. If you see it, protect it. The monarchs need it. The baby little caterpillars, that's their only food that they will eat when they're eating those milkweed leaves when they're growing. So take care of your monarchs with those milkweeds and plant more of them. Find out by Monarch Watch and other places where you can get your milkweed plants. I know here locally we have the Hop and Blueberry Farm that sells milkweed plants that are adapted for this region. Ina Warren has written a voluminous milkweed book that describes every native milkweed all over North America. Find out more from Ina Warren, Monarch Watch, Make Way for Monarchs. Lots of groups out there If you love butterflies, they need our help urgently right now. And on the front of Seed Freedom and more places standing up for their heirloom organic varieties, Austria and Italy now ban the GM crops. They've got the EU opt-out being taken up by many, many countries. And now one of our latest, Austria and Italy, now opting out of growing those GM crops. So great progress to see around the world. And, of course, here we are, just in the thick of fall and our first freeze this week. Patrick Battle's with us now, giving us our insight from the garden. So, Pat, how'd you do in the freeze that we just had here a few days ago in the last few nights?
Well, it meant that I worked all day Saturday and I'm in sea law on Tuesday.
Yeah.
We had 770 pounds of sweet potatoes to get out of the ground so far. We're hoping that whatever was left, you know, the ones that stray to the side and stuff will still be good, that didn't get so cold that they're damaged. We'll cure them separately and eat them first. I'm estimating there's another 200 pounds to 300 pounds in the ground yet. And, you know, Saturday was spotty frost. Even at Mills River, Mr. Ed, the Okinawa spinach survived the Saturday frost. Even, it's interesting, Okinawa spinach, I guess, is quarter or maybe eighth hardy, which is exciting because that means that you could protect it with row cover and plastic and keep that green going so that you didn't have to start hitting your collards and your kale too early. You know, you could probably still be picking that into November before it got so cold that it killed. And then, of course, you could take cuttings and put it out again in the spring. So it's pretty exciting. That's new information to me. The flowers and all made it through Friday night. They didn't make it through Saturday night at Mills River. They did at the 4-acre field where the sweet potatoes were. That frost actually, you know, wasn't as intense. I'm sure by Sunday night they came down hard, though. It was considerably colder up here in Silo, well below 30 on Sunday night. We didn't take a chance on things like peppers, except for about 12 habaneros that I have out in the 4-acre field. I always isolate the habaneros from the sweet peppers, because if a pollinator does happen to hit both, the seeds of that sweet pepper will then be hot. So we had those out there alone, and they went in a little late, and I gave them a whole lot of sheet compost kind of feeding with juice pulp and leaves and stuff. So they put a lot of growth on before they started setting fruit. And although we got maybe 30 habaneros so far, there could be as many as 300 more on the plant. And I just wanted them to size up and start to color up. And of course, if I thought they couldn't survive the frost, I basically just put many layers of row cover over them. If I thought they couldn't survive the frost, then what I would do is come back after, you know, the peppers wouldn't be damaged even if the frost hit them. So I'd take a gamble like a gamble to survive. The peppers are usually being covered by that layer of leaves too. 90% of the peppers would survive that first frost unless it was like record-breaking cold, like down in the teens. So after that, I'd come pull that plant up, which wouldn't be dead. The leaves would be dead, though. And I would hang it someplace, and they'd continue to ripen on the plant, which is going to give you the best quality. And, I mean, people who can't take any heat will just think it's ridiculous to think about habaneros having taste, because all they experience is fire. But, of course, habaneros are a wonderfully flavorful pepper if you can figure out how to, you know, get that flavor available to people without setting them on fire. So that was the crop I was most concerned about keeping going. We were ready to let go of anything else. Fortunately, there wasn't a lot of stuff we felt like we had to extend. I guess there's some of the Thai squash in our what we call the back 40, which is a couple backyards that we also farm at Mr. Ed, and we covered those because they could stand to continue to ripen on the vine. The quality would be even better, and it's become one of our favorite squashes. So those, we probably did keep those leaves going. Because I left finally to get up to Silo on Sunday morning, I don't know how we fared on Sunday night. But I'm pretty sure Rocco's report was it got to about 30. The cover should be fine for that, you know. What folks need to know about that, and I'm going to be focusing on that tonight. I'm doing a season extension class tonight. And a key thing to focus on is you want to pick and choose your battles. You can't save everything as far as season extension goes. You decide what crops, you know, are going to be fine to harvest where they're at and what crops need to go for another week or two. Usually if you do some season extension, you can keep your crops going for 2, maybe 3 weeks, you know, oftentimes into November, depending on how heroic you get with your season extension. And so we picked and chose, you know, habaneros and Thai squash was about all we felt like we really needed to keep going. We did, of course, put the sidewalls down on all of our greenhouses and close them up. And so they didn't miss a beat. They didn't even need cover for this one. It will be interesting to see how many of the summer cover crops have died, because that's kind of an interesting aspect. You know, part of the no-till strategy is to plan on planting things like garlic and maybe other late fall, early winter crops through summer cover crops that have been frost killed. And so for that, you kind of want frost to come early. And I guess that's an advantage because you win either way. If the frost doesn't come early, you got a problem with your summer cover crops. If it does come early, your summer cover crops are taken care of. If it doesn't come early, of course, your summer crops, not your cover crops, get to keep going longer. So it really is like win-win that way. And not all summer cover crops will die with the very first frost. You need enough kill back to feel confident you can plant without a, you know, freakish warm spell causing competition for the next crop you put in. So it's pretty interesting. And it's a way to make sure you get to be positive no matter what occurs. You know, it's one of my favorite lines about, you know, gardeners and farmers is their first line of defense with frost is denial. And that only goes so far. You know, it does work very well for the early spotty frosts, because you usually come out pretty well. Even if you take a little bit of damage, it's so spotty that it wasn't worth the effort. But eventually, if you don't take it seriously, you lose treasured crops like peppers and Roselle and things that really will be damaged if they freeze. And so we kind of, you know, dance that one, you know, on the side of caution more than not. You know, what we've learned, and I have no idea why it is that way, but when the weather report says it's going to be below 40, we presume frost. And I'd say 75% of the time we're right, even though they're talking high 30s. By the time we actually get up to the day when they say it's going to frost, they're now saying mid 30s, which for Mr. Ed, which is, you know, in a bowl, and so right where all the cold drops, you're going to get frost. You know, Saturday morning I woke up, looked at my maximum minimum thermometer for the outside temperature. I was up at 6:45, so it hadn't warmed up significantly at all. It was 38 degrees at my house, right next to my house, of course, and I'm up on a hill. I got down to the farm, and there was significant frost all over the place. It was not thorough. There were places that didn't get it, and none of the high stuff, the okra or the flowers, got hit. Only the roselles that had fallen over got damaged, but it was definitely much colder down there, and that's something for people to be aware of, and we'll talk a little bit more about that on the show, kind of a teaser for tonight. But so that's how we did. How'd you do with the frost?
Well, you know, the roselle took forever to start to bud. I was just starting to get some flowers just start to open, and then of course it looks horrible now, and I was wondering if I can still harvest those even if they haven't really bloomed. They've got those beautiful burgundy, you know, with the calyx and the outer waxy covering, as you mentioned, but they didn't really get to flower yet.
Oh, you know what, you missed the flower.
That's miss it?
Yeah, the calyx and the seed pod cover is what you harvest. The flowers have been happening. They look like okra flowers. Somehow or another, you've just been missing them.
Well, I just saw one starting to come out, and I said, oh, there's the first one, and then it was already gotten first.
If you have the waxy covering and all that, you've had flowers for every one of those waxy calyxes and seed pod covers.
Well, I'll try it. I will pick those because they look okay, and then see if I can simmer up some yummy stuff with that or not. I'm not sure because I really didn't notice them.
If it looks waxy and doesn't look like, you know, like it's frozen, it'll have that frozen look. You know how frozen stuff has that, you know, discoloration, kind of darkening?
Right. All the leaves have that, but those little, you know, flower things don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not flower things. They're seed pod covers and calyxes.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll try it. I'm just hoping. I was like, oh, darn. I hope the roselle is still salvageable. And
yeah, I was surprised to hear you were getting your first one that late. They've been happening. You've been missing them.
Okay.
They're easy to miss. They're, you know, in the okra family, those flowers are all one day flowers, you know.
Right.
And I don't even know if you call it a seed pod cover. Frankly, it's, you know, it may be part of the calyx, but it does extend over the seed pod, and it's that waxy red, high vitamin C, luscious tasting, very, very edible when fresh, and very, useful for tea are, as you said, simmered up into a honey, with honey and a little bit of water, into probably the, and what most of us thought was a superior version of cranberry sauce.
It was fabulous. I loved it. And, you know, of course, you had advised me to go ahead and leave those Chinese cabbages in the ground because they just weren't ready. And so I left them all through summer, and I was waiting for the first frost because you said that would sweeten them up. So finally got to, I decided right after the frost to go ahead and pick one of those Chinese cabbages and had a delicious stir fry with that. And I don't know how long you think, like, typically if you get a more of a sweetness ratio if they go through more frost, but I just did it for one or two nights and then I picked one. But
without cover, they'll take damage. With cover, they can go pretty far into the winter, and unless you see them starting to go up, you know, get a little long at the bottom, they're not going to bolt probably until after solstice.
Yeah. Well, they were delicious, and I've still got other cabbages out there. We've been doing, I don't have a greenhouse yet, but we've been doing covering and uncovering each day, and it's done, doing pretty well. I have a ton of white icicle radishes that are getting ready, and the other turnips are just starting to get their, you know, their legs on. So, but the lots of radishes, I've got black Spanish radishes and a bunch of different nice little fall radishes to do. So I'm probably going to have to maybe ferment some of those and share a bunch because I've got way too many. But it's great because we're doing passive tillage via these plant roots. The icicle radishes are doing a wonderful job of loosening the soil.
Yeah, you can do that with all of them. And of course, you know, as you know from the brassica class, they also are good for doing, you know, essentially biofumigation if you had any soil diseases. You know, they're you know, every plant contributes to the soil. They all contribute differently, and the radishes do some tillage for you. And don't forget, Lisa, you not only can eat those all raw, every one of them will cook up fine, too.
Oh, good. I was wondering.
Yeah. You think, you know, you may be able to, and you can also not only pickle them like, you know, pickled radishes, but you can shred them and pickle them more like classic sauerkraut. So you have many uses for those radishes. You know, I always encourage people to think they have too much food to realize that this is what you grew yourself. And I don't know if there's anything more powerful than eating what we grew ourselves. As far as when you eat it, I mean, there's just a certain connection that you have. So I'm going to try and encourage you to find ways to eat those radishes yourself. Not that it's not powerful to share with your friends and community, too, but there's a lot of uses you can find for those radishes.
Oh, good. I was wondering, I was going to ask you about cooking them because I've never really cooked radishes, but I've been, since I was making kimchi last year, I know they use them a lot in various ferments, but I thought, well, you know, why wouldn't you be able to cook them? They're remarkably similar to turnips, and I the chickens have certainly been enjoying some of the greens. I told you I've had abundant greens because we have too much nitrogen going on, so I'm hoping that we can suck up some of that nitrogen as well. Been mowing a bunch of the dry, good leaves and bagging them and spreading all that mulch out to also do that carbon base for getting some of that nitrogen balanced out as well as you recommended last week.
Yeah, I think you'll quickly find the nitrogen's a very fleeting thing. You can have too much one year and not enough the next year. So,
yeah. Oh, boy.
But don't worry about it because there are plenty of sources of nitrogen. It's really not something that we need to worry about. If you just pay attention and make sure you access them, you'll always have enough nitrogen.
Yeah, it's
important. You don't want to not take it seriously, but it's not a big, you know, frankly, I find having enough stalky material to make good compost or enough high carbon material to mulch with a lot harder than nitrogen sources.
Right. Yeah, they've got some fairly puny roots on some of these radishes and just a few really rightly sized ones. And so, yeah, you can definitely tell there's just this massive foliage going on.
Well, they're going to get the signal as the days shorten and the cold hits to make roots. And with all that top, they should make some spectacularly juicy, sweet, and wonderful radishes. So I wouldn't give up hope with them, you know?
Okay, so just wait them out a little bit.
Yeah, and, you know, if it gets cold, really colder, use row cover, mulch them out, you know, mulch the roots so they don't freeze. Because they'll get that kind of corky look if they actually freeze.
Right.
But you should be able to push those well into December and have amazing radishes by them. And that's...
Patrick just disappeared there. Let's see if we can get him back on the line. The mysteries of internet. Let's see if we can get him back on. Earth Art Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition. Pat, can you hear us?
I got you back. I don't
it
know
just
happened.
Jumped off. I just called you right back. Yes.
Yep.
Please proceed. I'm so glad to hear that because I thought we had to just get those radishes out of the ground in their puny state, and it's good to hear they're not going to just become little chunks of wood that they can actually size up once
until
we get the colder.
Until they size up, they're not going to get woody.
Okay.
They'll get woody once they've gotten past the size that they're normally good to eat at, because then they're going to make seed. They're going to take the energy out of that root, and that root's going to become woody as they're taking the sugars and stuff that they need to make the seed out of it, you know.
Awesome.
And that shouldn't really happen until sometime into December, I would assume, because most of them are day length sensitive and cold sensitive, you know. I might be surprised. I don't know. Every radishes have a range over the, you know, like watermelon radish, if you didn't plant it, you know, sometime between the end of the first week of August and the beginning of the second week of September, odds are good it won't make much of a radish. It really needs that photo period to make that nice radish, you know. Other radishes, you know, like shunkyo, you can plant it any time of year. It's going to make that nice half-long red, sweet, slightly hot, wonderful radish that's got a wonderful tops for cooking, you know. So they all have different day length needs, but I'd play with them. If I don't know the Spanish one at all. It was, whenever I tasted it, it was always too hot for me. But what's exciting is you can grow it in a deep cold, and if I am going to eat hot and radishes, I want them to be sweet too, and you should get wonderfully hot sweet radishes from that one.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I know they're the most acid-binding food, that black Spanish radish, and so I was just been very intrigued by it. And, of course, I have deep, deep Spanish roots, and so I wanted to grow something that might have been something from part of my lineage there. But very interesting. I haven't really had success with them before, but they look like they might do well. I hope. I hope so.
You've got luscious greens this time of year. They should make a good root, you know. You got to protect them, you know, and I protect them not only with cover, but also with mulch. And then if it starts to get bitter cold, then that layer of plastic over that. So just be ready, be set up, you know, and you can bring all that stuff right along.
Right, and I have an inadvertent summer cover crop of a zillion little volunteer tomatoes, of course, that all died. And so now we've got a nice little mulch that is there from all of those little tomatoes that seeded out right there as the fall garden was being planted.
Yep, it is always true that any plant that's covering your soil is a cover crop if you let it be. You know, I mean, I wouldn't get too carried away with poison ivy or nutsedge or something like that, something that's going to become a problem. But loads of things, or you might also decide something like galansoga, when it starts to show flowers, you might decide, I'm going to mow it so that those flowers don't happen, you know, because you may not want to get endless seeds for galansoga since it's such a rampant weed. But up until it's starting to flower, It's putting its exudates into the soil, keeping the soil protected from rain and sun, and making carbon for you. So why would you take it out, you know?
Great. Well, it's season extension time. Looking forward to the class tonight. It'll be at the Mills River Educational Farm, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, some things I'm going to talk about for this is there's a few aspects of season extension. One is extending the crop you had. And the other is extending your ability to grow food into the winter, you know. And lots of times the same infrastructure can use both ways, you know. So right now you're covering the crops you're trying to save. But you're not going to be able to save them for that long unless you go to really, you know, heroic lengths, which most of us aren't willing to do. So by the end of the month, probably you're going to have all this material that you were covering your summer cover crops with. And you may have beds that you sowed to all kinds of salad greens, turnips, you know, things that will do well this time of year, and they can take it fine. I mean, that tiny little hardy plants, the cold just doesn't touch them. It doesn't matter how cold it gets. They're just not big enough, far enough away from the soil to really ever get hurt, you know. But as they get bigger, they're going to need help, especially to get them to mature. So you can take what you had covering your summer crops and put it over on your winter crops and use the same infrastructure again. You know, it's all about resources, and not all of us want to have the space for or the money to buy enough to cover every last bit of our garden. But you can use the same season extension materials to extend the season many times. You know, you may decide towards the end of the winter that you are done with the things you were protecting, and now you can put them over the areas that you want to get stuff in early with, you know, so you can use same materials over and over again. And we're going to talk about the different things you can use to make hoops, whether that be 9-gauge wire, which you can get at hardware stores, is probably the most cost-effective, though not the strongest or most satisfying to use, or PVC pipe, which you can also often get recycled, the white being much stronger than the black, but both will work, and about how you can use either you know, straight pieces of saplings that are in the way. You know, maybe you need to thin your forest where trees have been cut down and many saplings are coming up. And you can cut them, take your loppers out and cut some good strong pieces that'll drive into the ground, put your pipe over that. Or if you don't want to have to go looking for saplings all the time, buy some rebar and put your pipe over that and you can make your hoops with that. Or you can decide, I want something that's easy to store, easy to use, and if I just remember to wear gloves, no big deal. I can do it anytime. They store out easily out of the way, and you can order from companies like Seven Springs Farm Supply, the fiberglass rods. But do remember to use your gloves because it's very easy to get fiberglass slivers, and that's no fun. And those are, I think, under $2 a piece, which to me is pricey, but very convenient. And you may decide to make that one-time investment. Once you have your hoops, you know you want to use row cover over the plants. If you're not going to use plastic too, you put the row cover over the hoops. If you're going to use plastic also, the row cover goes over the plants and the plastic goes over the hoops. And then you've installed what I call basically foolproof season extension. If the plant is half hardy, it'll make it through the winter easily. If it's something like quarter hardy, like the Okinawa spinach, you might need more protection to try and get it to go straight through the winter, but you can easily push it well into November if we don't get hit with some of that freakish early cold. So those are the kind of things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about what crops do best, how to deal with the fact that you can't cover everything, like, you know, pulling those tomatoes, pulling those peppers, hanging them up in a cool garage so that they can continue to ripen. They're not going to really size up more, but you can get them to ripen nicely and ripen. You know, if you get green peppers, they really don't taste that good. But if they sit on that plant, they oftentimes will ripen more rather than just stop where they are.
Right. I have a whole bunch of habanero that is ready to get ripe, but I only have had one ripe one. But I have a ton of fruit on that plant, and I've been covering it. But I would sure like to see those ripen up. And, you know, I've really enjoyed my favorite combination with habanero is mango. And they have that Smoke and Jay Fiery Foods. It's a local farm over there in Candler, and they have this smoked mango habanero sauce, and it just absolutely does give people the chance to get that flavor as well as a little heat. But it's really flavorful. So yeah, I really want those habaneros too.
I think you can pull it off. I mean, I do the heroics and keep it covered with plastic, and you could probably push them well into November. And the fun thing is, Lisa, the more you do that, the sweeter the habaneros are. You know? The cold, that's the nice thing about cold, is everything sweetens up with the cold. It's just basically the plants are growing slower, so they're not using all the sugars they have available, and those sugars function as antifreeze, and so it's a win-win situation, you know. So those habaneros obviously are not freeze-proof, but they're still going to be a little hardier from that cold, a little bit slower to freeze, and you're also going to have, you know, the protection of the fruits. And the fruits will be what you'll save eventually. Eventually, there'll be a night where you'll see significant damage to the leaves. But most of the fruits won't take damage because they're always under, you know. They're under those leaves, and so they're in a little microclimate of their own. And I bet you can push those for several more weeks. And if they're starting to get light-colored, loads of them will color up, you know. And to me, they're always best if they've ripened on the pepper in the cold. So good luck with those. I'm in the same boat trying to get a great harvest of habaneros. I want to smoke them. I want to ferment them. I want to play with a couple of different hot sauces.
Ooh, well, I would love to get those recipes, Pat, and we can share them with our audience as well. It's always, like you said, a challenge to get some very delicious things that bring out those nuances of flavor and not have it be just overwhelmed with heat. So I'd love to get some of those recipes that you're going to be trying out.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be making them up, so I'll let you know how they work.
Yeah, I'm making up all the time too.
Yeah, right. But I will then find out which ones work. You know, I hope to try a few, so hopefully one or two of them will work well. You know.
Yeah, it's helpful. Like when someone is, especially such as yourself, with so much culinary experience too, trying something out, and then you get to have not only the experience, like we get to enjoy from your gardening stuff, but you get to know, hey, how was it, and what might we be able to do better. So that'll be a fun thing to share.
I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, great. Any closing words you'd like to impart to us today as we might just freeze again and really get into that season extension time as the changing of the tide happens in our great cycle of seasons? I'm loving it.
Well, for me, you know, it's as the leaves detach and fall down, and I celebrate that moment, you know, it's of course bittersweet, you know. I mean, I'll confess I prefer all three seasons over winter. But I also love winter. I love all the seasons. But it's hard to let go of the warmth and the vibrance of growth among plants and all that when the world is alive, when the plants are awake and they're growing. But it is kind of a, you know, it's a little bit of a mantra as I watch those leaves detach and float to the ground. It's like reminding me to know how to let go. You know, I'm doing some cleanup here on the property. And of course, there's always things you think, oh, I could find one more use for this, you know, and maybe I just need to call Asheville. I mean, email Asheville Free Cycle and post it, you know. Maybe it's time for me to let go of that. Maybe it's time for me to let go of, you know, endeavors that just I can't really complete this year. You know, I'll have another shot at them next year. There'll be more things to figure out how to find a use for in the future. And nature does that. Nature has no choice. It just has to stop. You know, it's like time for these trees to go into a resting phase, to let their leaves drop and chill out for a while. And it's a good thing for us to do, to go out, to soak that in and let this be a time of, you know, taking stock and deciding, you know, where is it fruitful to put my energy? You know, in the garden, it's real stark. It's real easy to figure that out. And if you don't make those decisions, the next hard cold will. And that's okay. You can do that. But the longer you garden, the more you learn that if you make the decisions, you tend to be more productive. You tend to be able to get everything at its maximum value. And the same thing happens in life. You know, we oftentimes are unwilling to let go. And then we're forced to let go. And oftentimes that's messier. So for me, fall right now, as the leaves are particularly dropping heavily here in the mountains, it's a time for me to take stock and decide where best to put my energy. And I hope everybody else finds that to be what they get from this rather than just depression. You know, it's like definitely a little harder to accept the fact that when I wake up in the morning at 7 o'clock, it's still dark, basically, you know, and it's going to be colder and colder, but that's winter and there's loads to enjoy about winter. And I must embrace it, and therefore I do. And I wish everybody else as easy a transition and as much joy as they can find in the coming season.
Yes, it's so true. Autumn does show us how beautiful it can be to let dead things go. It's a wonderful thing to do, and that deep winter cold makes spring even more enjoyable.
Absolutely. I'll see you tonight, and talk to you next week.
All right, Pat, thank you so much, and we look forward to this evening's workshop. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That is Patrick Battle, This Week in the Garden, and certainly a lot of great information on how we can extend some of those summer crops, how we can keep planting some that will make it right on through winter, and just exactly how to manage that most efficiently out there so that we can enjoy that fresh food and keep on going with eating healthy and strong and encouraging that wonderful land-to-mouth food, farm, and garden connection every day in our lives. Earth Heart Network Radio signing off. Lisa Almaraz with you, looking forward to speaking with you again next week. We'll talk to you soon.